UK Wine Show, show number 302, London International Wine Fair and Brintex with James Murray and Will Broadfoot. Hello and welcome to this week's UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott and this is the UK Wine Show, the UK's best loved wine podcast. Things starting to quieten down here in the office a bit, so I've got a bit of spare time on me, which is brilliant. Been able to try and catch up with the administration and all sorts of stuff that you would do in the business here. Did go to the English Trade Tasting this week, which was quite a nice one to pop into, and had a wee sifty around on Thursday. Tasted about 100 wines. I've got a report on that in the spotlight this week, so we'll get onto that in a wee bit. But this week we're going to be talking with James Murray and Will Broadfoot. Will is the marketing director and James is the director for London International Wine Fair. And we're going to be finding out a wee bit about the history of the International Wine Fair. But before we get into that, let's start off with our mystery wine producer. And as usual, I'm going to give you a clue now, a clue before the interview, and then the answer at the end of the show. See if you can work out who this mystery wine producer is. Now, our mystery producer isn't actually that tricky, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a first clue that's going to be a wee bit cryptic. You may be able to work it out from that, and then the second clue should be a bit easier. And our mystery producer has 70% of their vines under a particular grape variety called Ferment, followed by Harsh Levilu and Muscat Lunel, with the remaining 5%. The vines are planted largely on clay or lossy soils with volcanic substratum. Yields are as low as 10 hectolitres per hectare. In fact, for the decadently sweet Arzu wines, which develop noble rot, one vine yields only one glass of wine. The winemaker, Corley Atz, who combines traditional technique with modern techniques to create a range that extends from the indigenous dry white Forment and its late harvest Asti Cuvée through to its 5 and 6 Pouton blends and single vineyard growths of Grand Cru wines. I'll give you another clue after the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. Many in the trade are watching expectantly to see if the 2011 En Primeur campaign will get off the ground or not. This will largely depend on whether the Chateau heed market demand that prices are dropped. Wine critic Robert Parker suggests a complete lack of demand for 2011 unless prices are dropped dramatically. His advice is to price low and sell quickly. And the market has been expecting dramatic reductions in price, but a number of estates releasing last week were only down by between 2 and 12% on 2010. And although Chateau Lafite Rothschild released with a 30% decrease, this was below the expected 50% drop. Meanwhile, Gary Boom of Bordeaux Index told Decanter.com that the Asian market is still smarting from buying overpriced 2010s, and a desire for the 2011s is non-existent over there. He said the entire campaign is on a knife edge right now, and releases over the next few days will dictate the entire thing.
Cost Estienal released earlier at 45% discount, which is encouraging. Carrion Angelou and Chateau Bellevue both released at £35 exporto, which is a 30% drop and a 21.35% drop, respectively, on their 2010s. As Jane said, other producers seem to have only come off a small amount from their high prices of 2010. What's the next story, Jane?
Well, the drinks trade secured around a dozen spots in the Sunday Times Rich List 2012, which was published last week. At number 48 in the Rich List, which is an annual survey of the UK's 1,000 wealthiest people, is the Grant and Gordon family, owners of William Grant, who are worth £1.4 billion. But several wine people do feature too. In 410th position are Tony and Barbara Lathwaite of Direct Wines. The couple are worth £185 million, up £80 million on last year. And Judy Halewood is in 428th position, worth £175 million. She took over Halewood International after the sudden death of her husband, John, last year. The company owns Krabby's Alcoholic Ginger Beer, Lamb's Navy Rum and Red Square Vodka and fine wine division Shirley Richards. 85-year-old John Rudd of wine merchant Berry Brothers and Rudd is in 569th position, worth an estimated £130 million. And in 596th position is John Apthorpe, the founder of Majestic Wine. His family has a £44 million stake in the firm. There's also Raj Chattha of EFB Holdings, which owns Whittle's Wine Merchants and which last year bought 37 odd bin stores. He's in 785th position, worth £95 million. And Robin Gabb, founder of Western Wines, is in 908th position. Going down, but still at number 441, worth 170 million, is Silvio Denz, who owns Chateau Forger in Saint-Emilion, among other wine investments, but made his money by floating his fragrance company Art & Fragrance. His worth has fallen by 13% on 2011, down £26 million.
Oh, these poor people, I feel sorry for them. But I should be appearing on the rich list soon. All I need to do is pop out and buy a lotto ticket and I'll be there. What's the next story, Jane?
Well, finally this week, it's feared that heavy frost in April may have affected up to a third of some Champagne vineyards. A warm March meant some vines were showing early signs of growth with early budding, but temperatures dropped to minus 3 degrees C in the Côte de Blanc, with villages like Avis, Cramont and Chouy the worst hit, while there was more widespread damage in the Côte de Bar, as temperatures there fell to minus 5. Chardonnay in the Côte de Blanc and the Grand Vallée de la Marne was said to be the most vulnerable, being more advanced with two or three leaves already growing in some well-exposed vineyards. Meurthe and Chandon say they could potentially lose 7 to 8% of their crop, with the worst damage in the Grand Cru of Avis and Aix, where up to 18% has been damaged. Other producers report that up to 30% of their vines were affected, but it's too early to see the impact on the 2012 harvest as new buds could still grow. That's it from me this week. Don't forget to visit our website, 3050.co.uk, for all these stories.
Cheers, Jane. I recorded an interview with Bob Lindo, owner of Camel Valley, one of the UK's top wine producers. One of the things he said in the interview was that the average yield in the UK is about 1 tonne per acre. A frightfully low number, and the reason for it is simple. Total crop loss from time to time, and it occurs quite regularly in the UK. It's one of the reasons that Bob and his team are not expanding and trying to keep the vineyard small. I think he's got about 50 acres there. So if a total loss occurs, his fixed costs don't destroy his business. As I said, I interviewed Bob yesterday. I did it at the English Trade Tasting. And in the spotlight this week, I just wanted to go through what I thought were some of the strengths and weaknesses of the English wines that I tasted there. And I thought I'd give you my impressions of the English Trade Tasting held on Thursday. I spent most of the day there and managed to taste all in all about 100-odd wines. But what I tasted was both good and different to normal. In general, the quality of the wines on offer was another step up in quality. The sparkling wines in general looking very good, and those made from traditional methods and traditional grape varieties were in fact very good. Some of the more Germanic-based sparkling wines fared less well, and many of the Sival Blanc wines that I tasted were a bit disappointing, and they had quite a bit of funk about them. The standout sparkling wines were again Camel Valley wines. Their white Pinot Noir and Pinot Noir Rosé Brew were the best that I tasted, and the Rosé was both the best wine I tasted that day, and also at 25 quid a bottle, I think it's probably one of the best value wines as well. The still Rosé wines were a bit disappointing for me, partly because I have such high expectations of English Rosé, but here again, Camel Valley Rosé really was only matched by Denby's Chalk Ridge Rosé. A Beckett's Rosé 2010 from near Salisbury was also drinking nicely and probably the best quality to price ratio out there. There did appear to be a trend towards sweeter rosés, which is a shame because I generally prefer the drier styles, and normally English rosé is both fresh and refreshing. The still wines for me again were a bit unusual. Normally I'd expect grape variety Bacchus to really shine out against all the other wines, but I found the standout wine for me was Shepherdown's Chardonnay 2010. The wine was minerally and lemony, and it just goes to show that good Chardonnay still wines can be produced in the UK. And at 12 quid a bottle, it's not massively expensive. There is a reserve version at £14 a bottle, and it had a bit more oak influence. According to the winemaker Josh, it uses three-year-old barrels, not so that you don't get too much influence in the wine. I did think the oak was still a wee bit disjointed, not as integrated as well as I'd expect. But that could happen over time, and certainly the wine has structured age for some period of time. Chapeldown still cements itself in the top position for what I think is the best still wines in the country, and under their new winemaking team, they've carried on the production of making good quality still wines. Both Biddenden from Kent and Brightwell from Oxfordshire were showing very well, and certainly some nice wines from more traditional grape varieties such as Dornfelder and Ortega. Last year's surprise winery for me was Gusbourne Vineyards, and I tried their wines this year with some enthusiasm. And not quite up to the standards set by market leaders Camel Valley and Ridgeview, they did do very well and proves that they will be a force to reckon with now and in the future. For me, this year's surprise was Hampshire-based Jenkins Place, who made both sparkling wines and a sparkling brew wine. Both drank very well, and I'd recommend you keep an eye on Gusbourne and Jenkins Place as dark horses that may sneak up the inside rail on more famous producers in the future. So I think, in general, English wine's still going strength to strength, getting stronger. There's now over 400 vineyards in England. I think it was 412 I read. So really, really starting to pick up momentum. And a lot of bigger vineyards, you know, larger sizes. Anyway, let's give you the second clue in our mystery wine producer. And our mystery producer was founded in Hungary in the 1990s by wine writer Hugh Johnson and a group of private wine investors to revive the revered and almost forgotten Arzu wines of the Tokaj region. It has become a private limited company in 1993, in which Johnson was joined by fellow Englishman Ben Hawkins and Danish-born Bordeaux winemaker Peter Vinding Diers. This Tokaj producer was the first foreign company to invest in Tokaj wine region and was a catalyst for the Hungarian government to privatise other state-owned vineyards. This mystery producer is a founding member of the Tokaj Renaissance, dedicated to re-establishing Tokaj Arzu as one of the world's greatest wines. If you know anything about this producer, you will definitely know it. If you don't, you've probably got no idea. But I'll give you the answer to it after the interview, which is coming up next with James Murray and Will Broadfoot. We're going to be talking to him about Brintex and the London International Wine Fair. Let's have a listen to what these guys have to say. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Will Broadfoot, the marketing director, and James Murray, the event director at Brintex, the people behind the London International Wine Fair. How are you, James?
Very good, thank you. Very good.
Excellent. And Will?
All good, yes, indeed.
Excellent. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about the London International Wine Fair. I did introduce it as Brintex, though, which is a people may not have heard about it. If you're in the wine trade, you would have certainly heard of London International Wine Fair. But Brintex, well, let's start with that. What is Brintex?
Brintex is an event organising company. So we run a number of exhibitions and events within different industry sectors. That said, the largest and the highest profile event that we run is the London International Wine Fair and Distill.
Okay, and you say and distill. We'll get onto that in a minute, because distill is just slightly different, but sort of the same, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, in summary, distill is our spirits area alongside the wine fair. The largest part of our sort of exhibiting community are our wine producers, agents, distributors.
Mm. Okay, let's talk a little bit about Brintex for a second. When did you guys start out?
1963. So quite a bit of heritage, and one of the largest independent organisers in the UK.
What do you mean by independent? So
we're a private business.
Oh, okay. Who owns the company then?
It is a family.
Yep.
A brother and sister at the helm, John Hemming and Louisa Service. So lots of history to the business, over 100 years old, mm-hmm. if you take into account our publishing side of things as well.
Okay, because you're right next door to Random House, I noticed, as well. It's nothing to do with them?
No, we're much more sort of business-to-business publishing and events. That's the sort of nature of the business.
Okay, so the events sort of fall out of your publishing business, does it?
To an extent, although interestingly, within the wine and spirits industry, we don't have any publications at all, which we always feel is a strength, because we're able to work with all of the relevant publishers, you know, and sort of media outlets within the wine and spirits sector.
Oh, fair enough, fair enough. Let's have a look at the London International Wine Fair. How long has that been running for?
Oh, gosh, we're into 32 years now. So from humble beginnings above a department store in Kensington.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. It was.
Was it called the International Wine Fair back then?
I think it was just called the London Wine Fair.
Yep. Yeah.
And it was a handful of stands, literally above a department store. Derry and Toms was the name of it. It's just grown and grown, and we've moved venues a few times. The last big change was 10 years ago, just over.
It was Earl's Court, was it?
Olympia, yes, indeed, yeah. We went from Olympia to Excel in 2002. And have been there ever since, so it's been around for quite a while.
Yeah, it's quite a big place to walk around. I always walk the place in the first morning, and that takes up pretty much the morning, really.
Yeah, I think in terms of the size, we wouldn't want to be too much bigger. You get to a scale which is almost unmanageable for visitors. It's scalable enough that there's plenty for people to see and plenty for people to taste. So we've got that sort of diverse mix on a manageable level. The move from Olympia really was as a result of sort of outgrowing Olympia, but we also found that with the glass ceiling on a hot May day, the wines were bubbling and it was getting quite hot and sweaty and quite difficult to do business. So XL is a little bit more of a sort of purpose-built venue that allows business to happen and allows us to run an event at the scale that we do.
What are the type of people who come to the London International Wine Fair?
Well, we're 100% trade. That's the important thing. Every visitor who walks through the doors has a trade connection to wine and spirits. That could be quite varied, in fact. As you'd imagine, there's an awful lot of merchants walking through the doors, mm-hmm. independent merchants, people working for off-license chains, shops, supermarkets, that side of things. But there's an awful lot of on-trade visitors as well. And by on-trade, of course, we mean those people who work in restaurants, supermarkets, restaurants, bars, hotels, pubs, anywhere where wine primarily is served and then consumed on premise. And these guys, yeah, they're bar owners, they're restaurateurs, they're sommeliers, of course. They make up probably, I'd say, a quarter of the entire visitor audience. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, you've got the sort of trade at large, people involved in import, people involved in packaging, glass even, design, all the different marketing services that would go side by side with the trade. And then there's a large number of overseas visitors as well, who we kind of treat slightly separately to the UK standard visitor.
I remember we had the volcano Iceland a few years ago, which sort of took off just as everybody was about to arrive.
We've been unlucky. We've had volcanoes in recent years. We had tube strikes last May, and swine flu was the other one. I think we're due a clean bill of health this year. But international buyers are usually, you know, they're usually very, very important to any major trade event. They add a level of stature to a trade event, and we created something called Club Elite, which is basically a VIP buyers club, of which a lot of these buyers are members, and we give them sort of special treatment to try and enhance their visit. And that's proved very successful in getting the likes of the Swedish monopolies, Systembolaget, you know, big German importers over, American retailers. You know, we work hard behind the scenes making sure that these sort of multi-international players are coming and getting benefit from the fair, just as we do someone with an independent wine store in the home counties.
I suppose from an exhibitor, you know, if you can get into one of the Norwegian monopolies, then that's worth quite a bit of money to them.
Only a year or so ago, Systembolaget, I think, was considered the buying monopoly for Sweden, the single largest buying group in the world.
Oh, okay.
So to have their buying team using the show as a method of sourcing new product, doing their business, which they do every year, is a fabulous opportunity for exhibitors looking to expand into that market. And the same goes for all of Scandinavia. We've been told that the morning of the fair, the 7:30 flight out of Stockholm might as well be reserved purely for the wine fair, because everybody from all the monopoly buyers and the big importers are on one aeroplane, and they reckon the business starts in the departure lounge before they've even made it to City Airport and XL.
So oh, really?
Yeah, it's powerful. It's big stuff.
Yeah, okay. And before we drill into sort of more about the exhibitors and some of the things you guys want to achieve out of the shows and this year's coming show, who do you compete with? You know, I know of Pro Wine, and we talked about Bordeaux. Yeah, Vinexpo. I've got to get myself down there one year. But, you know, Vinexpo, and then there's some events setting up in Hong Kong, isn't there? So
yeah, I mean, I guess on the global stage, the obvious one is Pro Wine. In Düsseldorf, obviously Vinexpo running every couple of years. I think, if I'm to be honest with you, the shows in Asia are tremendously strong. pull in very good audiences from that region, whether they be based in Hong Kong or perhaps more on a regional basis in China. So I think we're realistic about our ambitions of pulling Asian buyers to the UK. Mm. That said, Provine in Düsseldorf is a very strong show. Does very well in delivering audience from perhaps closer to home. We'd probably put them in the sort of competitive bracket. But then in terms of our domestic audience, there's lots of events running in the UK, so we have to work tremendously hard to deliver that extra difference and that extra bit of value, for our paying exhibitors and our visiting buyers.
What I like about this, you get a lot of trade tastings for, wines of all over the place. Is that sort of what you would consider a competitor, or?
I guess it's all part of the sort of competitive mix. One would hope that by getting involved in perhaps the generic tastings, it provides people with a platform to trade in the UK and even more of a reason to come to London. But ultimately, everything comes out of a central pot of money. Yeah. So people have to prioritise what they do.
And how many people do you get coming down from Scotland or North England? Is that a big pull, or is it, when you talk about sommeliers, is it just the people down the east end of London that are cruising in?
We're very realistic. If you were to divide the attendance from the UK into bands, if you like, mm-hmm. then clearly the closer you get to London, the wider those bands become. That said, if wine and spirits are central to your business, and of course there are many, many people for whom that is true right across the UK, then this is really your only opportunity to get everything under one roof. We work very hard on additional content at the show, so not just the exhibitors and the wines themselves, but the programmes of seminars and tastings, masterclasses, briefings, and we try and make these as attractive enough to ensure that if wine and spirits are that important to you, this is something you can't afford to miss.
Yeah, Will's absolutely right. And in fact, that is, in our minds, one of our biggest sort of challenges and opportunities for 2013 is the domestic marketplace and how we pull more visitors from further afield. So we've got quite a lot of initiatives in place that we think is going to deliver that sort of, that extra value for the exhibitors. So, it's exciting with a couple of months to go.
Cool. All right, and let's talk about this year's show. I noticed New Zealand weren't going to be attending first year for a long time that they haven't attended, but they've pulled out of various shows off and on over the time. Do you know why they've done that, or?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult. If you look at the international pavilions that we have, behind the scenes, they all operate quite differently. And also, they're at a different level of maturation. So certainly New Zealand's very strong in the UK, very established. So a lot of the producers already have sort of agents and representation over here. So for some, they may come with their sort of UK partner. The one thing I do know with New Zealand is that they don't have the benefit of any funding to set up their pavilion at the show. Other countries do. Yeah. So what it means is that to have a significant presence, that cost has to be shared between a lot of producers. And unfortunately, this time around, they just couldn't get the sort of critical mass to ensure that it was cost effective for everyone involved. That said, as a result, we've had a number of producers coming to us directly. So we're currently looking at trying to sort of, book a few of those guys onto the floor plan. But they are at a generic level. They're the sort of exception to the rule. It's frustrating. Disappointing. But we have to respect the fact that to achieve what they were looking to achieve, there has to be a tipping point in terms of the budget available for people to get involved on a sort of national pavilion basis.
But you do have all sorts of odds and sods around. I remember last year there was a Russian sparkling wine producer there, yep. Which is the first time I've sort of seen that sort of coming along. What I quite like, because we record a lot of shows at the event, is that there is if you get a generic tasting, you get wines from there. Whereas your show, you've got all sorts of weird things. You know, last year I recorded some shows with label makers, people selling kit for labels, just because it's a bit of a strange one. And the glass manufacturers, obviously, all sorts of people. The Benevolent Society were there, which is even, I wouldn't have necessarily expected to see them take a stand somewhere. So there's quite a lot of quirkiness in the show as well, which you don't get perhaps at some of the generics.
Yeah, no, you're right. We're not exclusively wine. It's everyone involved in the trade. At the supplier end, and sort of going back to what you were saying, if you do then focus in on the wine, which is the largest part of the show, we really do believe that it's a tremendous voyage of discovery. Yeah, whether you're store staff in a Majestic, a retail outlet, or you're a buyer for a supermarket, or you're a sommelier from a restaurant, you've just got this tremendous opportunity for discovery.
Yeah.
And there really isn't anything in the UK that can offer that breadth of diversity. And of course, it's very, very tasting driven as well. So the opportunity to sort of compare and contrast is huge.
I find that there's too much wine to even contemplate getting through it all. When I'm there, I allow certain slots to taste, or I'm going to taste for 2 hours here, I'm going to taste for 3 hours there or whatever. And I just do what I need to. I find I need to be quite meticulous about it and planned about what I want to taste. So I walk the floor the first day, but then I use that as an opportunity to work out where I'm going, because you just can't get around the whole thing, I think. Mm-hmm. How do you think people should approach the show?
You're right. I think if everybody had the opportunity to walk the floor, which I love that expression, for day one, and just sort of make an agenda for day two, it would be a real luxury. Quite often, of course, people have a window of opportunity, especially if they're in the on-trade and they're getting out between service. They've got a busy restaurant to run at the same time. So we do whatever we can to make it easier for them pre-show in their planning. Most of this is, as you'll probably won't be surprised, is online. It's web-driven. We're launching an app this year to help people to connect.
On Android as well as?
It'll be on Android, yeah, all the platforms.
Okay.
Got it.
What about Windows?
Yeah, don't test my knowledge of app technology. We're assured it's going to work.
Okay.
I seem to recall from the paperwork it's iPhone, BlackBerry, Android. I can't answer the Windows question.
So, it's all about pre-show planning.
What will the app do?
The app will allow you to build bespoke lists, essentially, of people that you want to go and see. You can build your own agenda in terms of wines you want to try, of sessions and seminars you want to take part in, appointments and you want to physically make to meet with winemakers or suppliers. I guess it's like a mini self-made agenda in your own pocket. The website is kind of an extension of that. We've worked hard to put together an initiative we call The List in recent years, where we're trying to catalogue every individual wine at the show, which is quite a task when you've got 10,000-20,000 being exhibited over the 3 days. But, for a busy sommelier, if they know exactly which holes they want to plug in their wine list, and they can drill right down into the volume, the strength of the wine, or the region, then it can save a lot of time.
It's a bit like Tasting Buddy. I remember
it's driven by Tasting Buddy.
Oh, okay, it's those guys, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, excellent, because they did do their stuff a wee while ago. I remember looking at Tasting Buddy as an app years ago, but that was before smartphones were particularly smart. They were pretty dumb back then, and it was a bit clunky.
Yeah, this is I don't think we'll be able to deliver the sort of power search function in our first year via the app. So this will be through londonwinefair.com. As Will said, it's a phenomenal tool because it really does drill down in terms of percentage alcohol, region. There's loads of information there that allows you to at least sort of shortcut the wines at the show and come with a little bit more focus. We've also got dedicated exhibitor search functions on the site based around those companies that are selling to independent retailers, for example, those companies that are selling to the on-trade, mm-hmm. those that are exporting outside of the UK, and a tool that we've sort of branded as the Wine Fair Matchmaker is basically designed for anyone who's looking to sort of find new wines to import and represent at the show, be they coming from the UK or overseas, and marry them up with relevant producers that are hungry to do business with them. So technology has more and more a part to play for us at the Wine Fair.
What new exhibitors have you got this year?
Yeah, there's lots going on. It's a tough one because a lot of our new exhibitors actually come with our more established pavilions. So we're sort of compiling the lists at the moment, and it's quite difficult to spotlight everyone. And we've come close to ticking the box in terms of most emerging markets. But there's always a few surprises coming our way. Certainly at a sort of larger level, we're really pleased that D&D Wines are coming back. There's a whole raft of smaller wine producers who are coming on stream, partly within our small independence pavilion, which is very focused at the sort of, you know, the volume boutique end, but also sort of dotted around the show as well. Hard to spotlight lots of new international pavilions just because we sort of over the years, tick the boxes there with most of them.
Brazilians coming back?
I was going to say, this sort of, I don't really feel that I can call them emerging markets anymore because Brazil, Turkey, have worked really, really hard in terms of gaining more market penetration. And they're sort of they're almost in our mature bracket now in comparison to many of the, Eastern European countries that come along. They're back in strength. And it sort of goes full circle to the conversation we were having earlier about discovery. There's lots to find, whether you're looking at, really sort of, mature old world, new world countries, as well as, you know, those up and comers.
It usually has some quite nice stuff. I think there was like Vin de France is a reasonably new category in France anyway, you know, wines from anywhere in France basically. And I think there was a top 100 Vin de France wines last year, I think it was. Am I going to write?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
And I thought that was quite good because it gave people like myself a chance just to say, all right, we've got this new category. What the heck's going on here? Let's have a look at it. And I wouldn't say I tested 100 of them, but I got through a good 20 or 30 of them, which is a fair old crack for me in an afternoon. So you said that lectures and some of that sort of stuff is quite important, particularly for the trade, and I always sit on a few of them. What sort of things have you got this year that you think might be a particular highlight?
Yeah, I guess the analogy I give is, you know, we couldn't have the show without the exhibitors. Yeah, it's a slightly different model to a show like Provine, for example, where they charge, you know, 30, 40 euros to get in. Our visitors don't pay a bean. So, of course, our funding, our investment, if you like, comes from our exhibitors. Yeah, and they are our advertisers, if you like. And just like any good magazine, you need the sort of editorial to go with the advertising. And that's our sort of ethos with the Wine Fair, is to provide really compelling content, you know, that ensures that any business that comes does generate, you know, benefit on the back of it. So they can meet good suppliers, but they can also sit in on briefings and tastings and lots of different events. The new things that stand out to me this year, we have the Discovery Tasting, which is in partnership with the International Wine Challenge. That will be wines that have entered the Wine Challenge, but that don't have representation in the UK. And they are relevant for independent retailers looking to import directly, on trade, the same, multiple retail outlets. And there will be over 1,000 wines available to taste in there. And they will be set out by country and by style of wine as well. Yeah, which I think will really be a sort of a hub of activity, and I think prove quite interesting for visitors. At an independent retail level, We've worked really hard with off-license news magazine, and we're putting an independence lounge together. Will touched on our Club Elite program earlier,
yep.
but we want independence to feel welcome to the show as well. And so there'll be a lounge available to independent retailers. There'll be business clinics running in there. For 150 lucky retailers, we're also putting up a £50 bursary to cover travel costs of coming to the show and the associated costs of covering the business while they're away.
Yeah.
And hopefully that will pull in visitors from further afield. Crikey, the list is sort of never ending. We've got an evening awards on the Tuesday with Harper's, which is again designed and focused towards merchants as well as the on-trade, but acknowledging the trade at large as well. We have the finals for the first time at the fair of the UK Sommelier of the Year competition as well.
Oh, okay. Was that, is that an exam or a...
It's organised through the Academy of Food and Wine Service, and we will welcome the six semi-finalists to the show on the Tuesday, the Wednesday. They will sit through a variety of tests, including written tests as well as oral tests. In the afternoon, it'll be whittled down to three who will have to perform on stage in a sort of mock restaurant situation.
Images of Basil Fawlty.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because I think the customers are actually previous award winners previous finalists and winners of the Sommelier of the Year competition. So I don't think they hold back in terms of putting these guys through the paces. And then at the end, the announcement will be made as to who is the UK Sommelier of the Year. So that's exciting for us as well.
And Jared Bassier is the current person, isn't he? He's an international sommelier.
He is world sommelier, yes.
Is he competing this year or is he...
No, he's organising. So he's going to be relishing the opportunity to put these guys through the paces, I'm sure.
Okay, sounds like fun. I think we'll wrap it up there, Will and James. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
I spoke to James yesterday and he said that the Winette would be up today. I downloaded it, that's on Friday, and I had a look at it. It's all right. Needs a bit more content, I think, but it could be quite useful. James seems to think that if you search LIWF 2012, it'll come up. I searched for it in the Android Play Store. I couldn't find it. Eventually, I found it by just typing in London International Wine Fair, the whole thing, and I could find it then. So if you are going to the show, do have a look at that. The lab looks okay. I won't be officially reviewing it, simply because I think it's quite niche and I don't think anybody else, if you're not in London, will probably be worth it for you. But I will give you some feedback on it once I've had a bit of a play with it a bit later on. And just to finish up this week, we have answer to our mystery wine producer, and it was the Royal Tokai Company. Now, the Royal Tokai Company, as I said earlier, was founded in 1990 by Hugh Johnson and a group of private wine investors. They make Tokai Azu style wines, which are those deliciously sweet wines. And the main variety used is Forment. And they do a dry Forment as well. And you can pick it up at Majestics. And it's worth about 7 or 8 quid a bottle. Quite nice wine, actually. Definitely worth looking at. Obviously, the dessert wines are what they're really famous for. And I'll finish up this week with a quote by Talleyrand. Well, I'm not quite sure who Talleyrand is, but I like the quote. The only thing I would say is... if you think back to what George Osborne said or David Cameron about us all being in it together, the recession and all that sort of stuff, it doesn't quite make sense. But anyway, the quote is, champagne is the wine of civilization and the oil of government. Have we think about that if you're all in it together. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.